Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this Saturday morning, February 2nd. Happy Groundhog Day and happy Super Bowl weekend. Hope you're having a great weekend so far and glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. And you can hear us from anywhere online by going to 883wppb.org. And every show is archived on my website at annliguori.com. All right, Super Bowl fans, football fans, Patriots versus the Rams. Super Bowl 53. It's always hard to figure out those Roman numerals and how many Super Bowls there actually are, but we're talking about Super Bowl 53 this year at Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta, Georgia. 6:30 tip-off Eastern Time on CBS, and it's the first time this Mercedes-Benz Stadium, which is just technically amazing, will be hosting a Super Bowl, and it will be played indoors. And New England is trying to win a record-tying sixth Lombardi Trophy. They're playing in their third straight Super Bowl and their ninth overall with the Bill Belichick-Tom Brady partnership, which is just an incredible stat. Nine Super Bowls overall with Coach Bill Belichick and Tom Brady. Well, it's the 11th Super Bowl appearance overall for the team. And if the Patriots win, they will break a tie with the Pittsburgh Steelers for the most wins in playoff history, 36, in addition to tying the Steelers with the most Super Bowl wins, which is six. Their current five Super Bowl championship wins are tied with the Cowboys and the 49ers. So if they get to six, they will tie the Steelers. This will be a rematch of Super Bowl 36 played back in 2002, in which Tom Brady, he was in his first year back then as a starting quarterback for the Patriots, and he led his team with a game-winning drive to achieve just a stunning upset over the Rams. And, boy, I remember it like it was just yesterday. Kurt Warner was the quarterback of the Rams back then, and you remember for the Pats, Adam Vinatieri kicking the game-winning field goal as the clock was running down. It seems like just yesterday, but that was in 2002. 17 years later, Brady and Belichick are still going strong. They're still together, but the Rams, they're completely different. They're in a different city. They have a whole new different roster and coaching staff, and they have a quarterback who's only 24 years old, Jared Goff. Incredible story. And if the Pats win, and I'm picking the Pats to win, Tom Brady will become the oldest quarterback to win a Super Bowl. Tom Brady is 41 years old. Peyton Manning won a Super Bowl when he was 39. So, Tom, just an incredible story, being so physically fit and so mentally capable and pretty much not completely injury-free, but, I mean, but just the fact that he can, is still doing so much, so well at 41 in the NFL. Sean McVay, the coach for the Rams, he's only 33 years old. Compare that to Coach Bill Belichick of New England, who's 66. So talk about age difference there with the coaches and with the quarterbacks. Well, Tom Brady, I think, is just too tough to beat. Bottom line, he's just superior mentally, physically, has experience, has all those intangibles that you can't always put a finger on, but he's a champion, and he knows what to do under pressure with the clock running down, and I just think he's going to find a way to win, as he normally does. And even though the Rams' defense is better and they have the most destructive defender in the league, Aaron Donald, I just think Tom Brady and his offense will find a way to just figure it out and overcome any kind of challenges. So it should be a great game, and enjoy it. This morning, in honor of the really big game, I am going to replay a classic sports interview show with the great Deacon Jones, the Hall of Fame defensive end who used to play for the Los Angeles Rams in the 60s. And he's a guy who actually coined the term sack. He was nicknamed the Secretary of Defense, and he is considered one of the greatest defensive players ever, Deacon Jones. So in honor of the Rams being in the Super Bowl, I am going to replay a classic interview I did with Deacon Jones for you. I hope you enjoy that. And I'm also going to replay an interview I did with legendary quarterback Bart Starr. He led the Packers from 1956 to 1971, won two Super Bowls, was a two-time Super Bowl MVP, and just such a history lesson to listen to Bart Starr talk about his career and the great Coach Lombardi. So I hope you enjoy those two replays of my classic sports interview. And starting off the show, we'll shift gears into the golf business. And I caught up with Jim Nugent, who is the publisher of Global Golf Post Plus, a digital magazine providing premium quality journalism 7 days a week. So Jim and I've known Jim for a long time as a publisher, formerly of Golf Week, and now of Global Golf Post. And we'll catch up with Jim Nugent and also with Bud Garmany, the president of Garmany Golf. Bud owns this golf and travel company, which specializes in creating unforgettable golf and travel experiences. So all that coming up this morning on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. Sports Interview with Ann Liguori is brought to you in part by Peak Vision Sunglasses, Zero Distortion, patented dual zone lens technology. Learn more at peakvision.com, peakvision.com. And by Dune Jewelry and the Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com, D-U-N-E, Jewelry.com. Hi, I'm Ann Liguori, and my guest, Hall of Fame defensive lineman Deacon Jones. And you're styling. You are styling. Look at this shirt.
Well, I've got some good friends, you know.
Showing a little chest, too.
My wife makes this stuff. You know, she's good at it. Yeah, she designs
it. It's gorgeous.
I couldn't dress myself. I don't have that much class.
Come on.
Yeah, I'm a lineman.
Okay. So you can discard the class because you guys were tough. The fearsome foursome, right?
Yes, just four are probably the best football players that ever played the game of football.
Just four.
Well, that's all we needed. You know, we thought that we'd spot the enemy, the other seven, and let him have seven extra guys.
You had Merlin Olsen.
Yes.
Who's now selling flowers.
Yeah, well.
And doing a little bit of broadcasting.
I won't be held accountable for that part. But, yes, Merlin Olsen was the tackle, and Rosie Greer and
Lamar Lundy. Rosie Greer, he's a preacher now.
Yeah, well, you know, guy got to make a living. I guess he's trying to atone for all the quarterbacks that he killed.
You know? What about you, Mr. Sack?
Well,
you invented the term sack.
Yeah, that was part of my makeup. I live a very quiet life now. I do Ram broadcasting, and you know, that's up and down, and you know how tough that is to do. And I'm reliving those emotional days that I had to deal with in football.
How did you come up with that term, sack?
Sack? Well, you know, when I came into the league, you got to remember, football was nowhere near what it is today as far as publicity is concerned. The game was just probably in its infancy stages, but it was still an old game. But they had just learned how to merchandise and market the game. And they still, at that time, was marketing the receivers and the quarterbacks, the running backs, the hot shots, you know. But what makes this game tick, as you know and I know, is defense. So when I came in, tackling the quarterback, which I did for a living, had no immediate reference to it. So the fan had no tie-in to it, you know. When you hit a quarterback, man, if you hit him wrong, you might get more flack from it during that time than anything else. So we had to come up with something that identified what we did, and that was tackle a quarterback. Now you've got to get a name that will fit into the headline. I mean, it's just like not going in the drawer and picking out a name.
Right.
It's got to be something that the newspaper man will get excited about, and it'll fit in the headline. And so Deacon invented the term sack, and for that reason, I always felt like if you took all the offensive linemen and you put them in a bag, and you gave me a Louisville Slugger and let me beat on the bag, you know, I mean, that's the way my thinking was.
What an imagination.
When I played, and that's where the whole foursome's thinking was. We were always looking for ways to take our game to another level and take what we did for a living to another level, because we didn't get publicity then. You know, we're probably one of the first defensive lines that really got publicity. You know, being in Los Angeles helped. But after we got started, you noticed Minnesota Vikings came up with a line with a name,
the
Dallas Cowboys.
The Purple People Eaters.
Right.
And
so everybody
the
started
steel
to.
Steel curtains.
Yeah, yeah. And it took the game to another level. And it brought out the things to me that was important to the overall development of the game, which is what makes this game really tick, and defense make this game tick.
But all of a sudden, the term sack was born.
Yes.
Who picked it up? Some newspaper guy?
Being a pretty violent player, I got a lot of media coverage, and sack was catchy, and it gave, I think, I'm so proud of the fact that it gave football an identity, because the word is used on every level of football.
117 sacks.
When?
Between 64 and 69.
Yeah, that's true. Between
overall,
64.
It was 180.
Right.
I see. You know your stats.
That's right.
So wait,
oh, yeah.
Wait, make sure you get the full 180 in there.
As you know, the league did not start officially
until 1982.
I have been punching and pushing this thing for a long time, because I don't think it's fair for this to happen. I mean, there's a lot of guys out there who gave a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to this game and did a lot to make this game what it is today. And to just open up a statistic as important as rushing a passer and just forget about the real guys who could rush the passer. I mean, when you look at the numbers, Reggie White and Lawrence Taylor fall fifth and sixth on this list. And I think that need to be brought out, because, number one, it inspires the young people that comes into this game to chase the real record, not one that's not the real one. And I'll always be there, whether the NFL makes it official or not. My 180 will always be there. And every kid or every person that gets involved in this game in the future will ask, well, why? Deacon Jones played four quarters, didn't he? Deacon Jones played 14 games a season, didn't he? So why is his stats not included with these? Are they false? I mean, so all you do is open up questions if you don't go back and clear the problem up. So that's what my whole thing is right now, is to get the NFL to bring it up. Whether I'm in front or not, doesn't matter, but let's respond to it.
Set the record straight, 180, mm-hmm. And don't forget it.
And don't forget it,
we'll
folks.
Be back with Deacon Jones
right
after this.
I'll break your nose.
We're back with Deacon Jones, who was a member of that great defensive line of the 60s, a fearsome foursome. And he is here right now, as mellow as can be.
Mellow as a cello.
Just like a lamb. All you guys were lambs off the field, weren't you?
Well, I tell you, you know, football is a violent sport. I mean, I'd like to just, you know, follow up on what you just said, because sure, I would like to have been a lamb in my business. I would have liked to have gone home after a hard day at the office and felt, you know, like just tired, not beat up and tired, you know. So I realized early in the game that my business was violent. And the more violence that I perpetrate on the opposition, the less I have to accept. So I worked very hard at making their lives miserable as I possibly could.
How did you turn that off when you were finished and went home?
Well, it's not an easy task, you know, because what the problem is when you work all week to prepare for something, and then you go out there and have it happen all the opposite way, you know, and you can't do nothing about it. And then you have to eat that, you have to live with that until you can get back out there, start the work process all over again, and then go to Sunday and try it out again. you know. So you live a life of ups and downs, peaks and valleys.
And waiting for that next game.
And waiting for the next game.
Prove yourself again.
All over again. Whether you played good this week or whether you didn't play good this week, the process starts all over again.
So could you turn it off when you went
home? Yes, I could. You learn that. You learn that. Well, you know, you don't start this game in the pros. You start this game all the way back to Pop Warner. And then you go through the different stages of this game, and you learn as you go. If you survive those stages, you learn how to deal with the game versus life versus the people around you. You know, it's tough in the beginning.
Is it tougher now with the current atmosphere because of the money and the greed? And it's just there's more pressure, it seems.
Well, see, money's a numbers game. My point is that money and this game is two separate entities. Okay, now, as far as players are concerned, the quicker they learn to separate the money from the actual performance on the field. Now, I held out 1 year in my whole career, and that was 1968. And I refused to go to camp under any circumstances until we straighten out this. Because once once my uniform goes on my back, I turn into that animal that we talked about. And then I don't think about money no more. All I think about is a quarterback or a halfback.
But it was settled before
okay?
the season started.
Yes, I have to settle it because I can't go into camp and play half of football.
Right.
You can't get a little bit pregnant.
Sure.
Either you're pregnant or you're not.
Well, the intensity obviously was there.
Yeah. What I'm trying to say is that if you haven't settled your differences, then you stay home until you settle your differences.
So you agree with that
mentality. Yeah, when the uniform goes on, it ain't about money. It's about my commitment to my teammates, to my fans, and to the game itself. That's a separate issue. See, you cannot ever play this game and get paid enough money for it. You know, everybody gripes about what a football player makes, and he's the last guy on the totem pole. You know, I like to see any person, any human being, put their body through what we put our bodies through for the short amount of time. And we spend more time training and preparing for our game and very little time playing it. So if we made $1 million a minute, we'd be underpaid.
Are you hurting now, physically?
No, I'm the deacon. You understand? The rest of the boys hurt, but I refuse to hurt.
Forgive me for asking
no,
that question.
No, I didn't get any.
I should have known better.
No, really and truly, I didn't get any.
I mean, but
any.
You went through, obviously, all the pounding, all the grinding, all that physicality had to affect you a little bit.
Yeah, but I was lucky.
I understand that you were thrusting the pain on the opponent. But
I was lucky. You know, and I admit that. I mean, I was lucky. You know, I stayed in real good shape, and my style of play kept me from getting a lot of injuries because, you know, I didn't get no operations. And when you don't get no operations, means you know nothing is removed from your body.
Sure.
When they remove things from your body, you can't grow it back. You understand? And like now, you've got to go on a lifetime training program to always keep that joint solid and sound. You understand what I mean? Well, I was lucky. I didn't get no operations.
I mean, for as physical as you were, as that foursome was, to have no injuries is quite.
Yeah, I had none. I had none. And now all I do is fight my weight. And if I keep that in check, you know, I'm solid as a rock. Now, the wear and tear does bother you, the bumps and the bruises and the hitting and the pounding every down. That is always going to be with you. I mean, my body will never be the same. You know, I hurt on cold days. I hurt when the weather changed. I can tell you better than the weatherman what the weather's going to be like, you know. But that's just from the constant pounding every down, you know. But I know guys who, friends of mine, who had operations, like Jim Otto. He had 9 knee operations. And,
tough.
You know, well, he hurt. He hurt every day of his life.
Oh, yeah.
I do not have a problem with anybody that makes as much money as they possibly can, as much money as the traffic will allow. This game produces a lot of income, okay? Before, during my time, I mean, we did not have the things in place that would dictate that we share in the revenue. I mean, we had to start from scratch forming a player association that protected us on the job, protected us salary-wise, and all the things that go with a union-type representation.
And we'll be back with Deacon Jones right after this. We're back with Deacon Jones, the inventor of the sack. The sack man. What do you think right now when these guys do the sack dance and carry on like they're at a disco?
Well, you know, to a certain degree, I understand exactly why that is, because, you know, a lot of owners now have understood, have started to understand, you know, that this is an entertainment business. I mean, you know, I wouldn't do it because, number one, is because the coaches in my day would not allow me to do it. I would get fined not only by my team, but by the league if I did something like that. You know, I got fined for wearing a pair of white shoes, and then Broadway Joe came along, and boom, everybody wore white shoes. You see, but when I stepped out with them in 1964, I got fined. They threatened to kick me out of the Pro Bowl. But see, the point is, things change. I think that any guy who chooses to do this is a form of expressing himself for the good achievement that he's just done. That's what it's about. But I don't find it would fit in my game because it's a wasted energy. They waste a lot of energy, and then you get in some of those pileups when all your teammates come to congratulate you for doing something good. It's some strong blows thrown in there.
The guys today, I know you think, could not compare to the physicality of a fearsome four line like yours or some other defensive lines back in the 60s.
Well, you have to look at this thing two ways. You know, everybody asks guys like me, well, could you play during this era? You know, I go to reverse. I say, could they play during my era? You see, because we were trained, we were more tested tough, I think, because we scrimmaged more against each other. Our training camps were a lot harder. See, so therefore, you're going to produce a lot tougher football player. I mean, we played with more injuries. I mean, we fought off a lot of the hangnail injuries that these guys go to the hospital with. You know, I mean, I wouldn't leave a game because of a concussion. You think I'd leave a game because of a concussion? I got to be completely out of my mind. No, I've never had a concussion. You know, you get in this tight, I'd have been in the hospital years ago if I let you in that tight. But no, I protected myself very well. But we were taught, trained mentally and physically, to withstand pain. And we did not go out for injuries like guys go out with now. But also, you got to understand one thing. They make a lot of money now. You see, a contract now worth $10 million or $20 million, you can't go out there for the love of anybody and risk that type of a contract. See, now we've gotten, you know, through technology and through game development, you know, people now can come in and tell management that you can't play my boy this week, or my boy this week is not gonna go because he's not 100%, okay? Before, you didn't have that problem because right. We had no agents.
Plus, you couldn't tell the coaches too much back then.
No,
the coaches
you couldn't tell them nothing. And you shouldn't be able to tell a coach nothing now, because you know either you got to have a leader, or you're not going to win.
But it's tougher now because the players are making so much more than the coach.
Well, we've always made more money than the coach.
But the disparity.
He's just a coach,
really.
You know. But it is a form of leadership.
Yeah, but he's the leader.
Yeah, it's a form of leadership.
Shouldn't they pay the coaches?
And you have to respect him.
Shouldn't they pay the coaches more?
No, I think they get paid too much now. But see, the point is that. Understand that football has to have discipline. A coach's job is to discipline those 53 men that he has. So you can't change what the coach want to do. Like the Hostetler and Snell fiasco was Hostetler was totally wrong. You don't have to get to nothing else. He was wrong.
Why?
Because he challenged the coach on the field of battle.
Right.
You don't challenge General MacArthur in the field of battle. Or General Eisenhower, you know, you don't challenge them. What they say wrong or right, gotta go.
You know, Hostetler rescinded those comments a couple of days later. Do you think that made it into a racist thing? Do you think?
No. I know Art very well, and Art wouldn't do a thing like that. But I'm saying, even before you get to those comments, he was wrong for whatever he said to the coach. For talking back. He was totally wrong. Now discipline is broken down when that happens. I mean, the coach put in the game plan. He's in charge of that. Only Al Davis can change that. You understand? The quarterback is the last guy, or any player is the last guy. Gee, when you allow that, then discipline is broke down. Okay? So what my point is that, as far as the racist part of it, I wouldn't believe that in a million years.
You don't think he called him you white quarterback?
Oh, man, if that had been Deacon, then yes, I probably would have said that. You probably could say, yeah, Deacon said that. Because I used to call Merlin white boy all the time, you know.
Did he call you black boy?
Oh, she got Merlin. We changed a lot of things. But he gets away with it because of the fact I know how he means it.
And you guys are good buddies.
Yeah, I know. Buddy had nothing to do with it. I know how he means it.
How did he mean it?
You know, you got to understand one thing. A friend can call you something, you know, and you know that it may be negative to the masses. But when the friend says it, you know it's not coming from here. It's a joke because it fits the situation that you both may be in. But then again, when it becomes a bigoted statement, is when you say it in a bigoted frame of mind. I bet any amount of money our share wouldn't say this in a million years. His personality is not that way. If Deacon Jones would have been the head coach and in that position, then there's a good chance I may have said that.
And you would have gotten in trouble,
didn't you? No, with who? First of all, he wouldn't have come up in my face like that. Because I'd have dropped him right there on the sideline.
He wouldn't have gone that far.
No, he wouldn't have gone that far. We wouldn't have been talking about a racial slur.
Right.
We'd have been talking about a right hand. That's what we would have been talking about. First and foremost, Hostetler was dead wrong. Because he challenged authority. And he challenged it on national television.
O.J. Simpson, you're from Los Angeles. Spent so much time. I'm sure you knew or you know.
Oh, yeah.
O.J. Simpson, what do you think of that whole situation?
I know Juice very well. He and I used the same barbershop. I played against him from 1969 through my retirement in 1974. I've attended a lot of affairs community-wise with Juice. As I said, I played against him at the height of his career. I don't believe one minute that he could participate or administer this kind of pain on anybody. I don't know the answers to the legal questions that's tied to this case. I don't think anyone knows that. We will find out in the ensuing months exactly what went down wrong. But if I had to answer the question right now about O.J. Simpson, whether he's innocent or whether he's guilty, that I would say, just like he says, he's unequivocally innocent of these charges. And it's going to take the proof in a court of law to convince me that he's capable of doing something like this. Until it's all put down on the table, and let's find out if O.J. Simpson is guilty. If he's guilty, then he has to suffer the consequences like any other American or any other person who committed a crime. But as a human being and the man that I know, I do not believe it until it's proven to me.
Thanks very much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you ought to invite me more often.
I will.
Yeah, thank you.
LaGore, and my guest is Bart Starr. Legendary quarterback, led the Green Bay Packers to 5 championships in the 60s, plus 2 Super Bowls. Super Bowl 1 and 2, and what a thrill that must have been, the early days of this Super Bowl phenomenon, the most watched sporting event now in the history of sports, practically aside from soccer, the World Cup. Got to get the World Cup in there. But what was that like, being a part of those formative years in the early 60s when put the Super Bowl on the map, basically?
You said it well when you were giving us the introduction. It was special. We were enjoying great success as a team at a time when the National Football League was soaring in popularity, so our timing could not have been better.
Today you look back at that team and it's legendary, and Vince Lombardi is legendary, and your whole offensive line is legendary with you leading the pack. But did you think that was the case when you were going through all those years? Did you know how special that team was and those years were?
We weren't thinking of it in those terms. What we were concentrating on was building a solid team, which he came there to do, and emphasize that word from the get-go, if you will. And so what we were attempting to do was to maximize the talents which were on that team and to come together as a team and begin winning championships. And in his first year, we had the first winning season in I don't know how many years. And it was a joy. It was such a wonderful turnaround. And from there, of course, then we went the following year, went to our first championship game, and the only one that we lost in 1960 to the Philadelphia Eagles. But we knew we were on our way back then, and that's what we were concentrating on, was playing great as a team and ultimately winning a championship. That was our objective.
What did he bring to the table right away that made the players respect him?
Leadership. Leadership begins at the top in any organization. And we had talent. There was no question about that. Because the Packers had finished so poorly for so many years, they were in a good position in the draft. And to their credit, they had drafted some good people. We had the core of a winning team. What we lacked was leadership. He came in and from day one provided that.
What was he like?
He was wonderful. Here was a person, Ann, every single day of your life, standing in front of you in a meeting, on a practice field, wherever, walking to a breakfast, that you saw epitomized a quest for excellence. And that's contagious. And I think that was spilled over on and to us so rapidly that it just engulfed us. But this is what the man was all about. In addition to that, he was an outstanding teacher. He understood people. He handled different personalities in different ways. Many people said he treated us all the same like dogs, and that was a great one-liner, but that was not true. He knew exactly how to extract from you and from me what we could best give and how to go about doing that. And so he was an exceptional leader. He had good people. He hired good assistants, and he put a top priority on teaching. He demanded that his coaches be excellent teachers in the classroom and on the field.
I remember listening to John Madden recently talking about the great Vince Lombardi, and when John Madden first coached, he thought he knew everything. He thought he was the best student of the game. He studied every play, and then he said he went to a seminar that Vince Lombardi gave, and Vince spent 8 hours on the Packer sweep. I mean, he just couldn't believe that there was so much to still learn.
Well, I'm continually amazed when I see the complexity of offensive terminology, and with no disrespect to any system, and there are some outstanding systems out there. Lombardi would show you a way to cut through that, to simplify it to a point where it would be so much easier to learn and understand that it would be incredible. He did that with a system that in those days was complicated, with a way you had to call certain plays. He went through and just slashed it all out and put responsibility for understanding what the terminology was on the different areas of the team, the line and others, where the quarterback had a very simple call. It made so much sense.
Yet, do you think you and your line could have thrived the same years, same team, under a different coach? Or was it that much Vince Lombardi?
No, it was that much Vince Lombardi. We had other coaches who were good coaches. They were smart, but they lacked his overall charisma and leadership ability, his way to instill discipline. As I said, his teaching ability. This was a man who took great pride in teaching, and he felt that coaching was the epitome of teaching, and it is in one sense. And that's how he came to you. That's how he built his strengths as it led into leading the Green Bay Packers.
What do you remember most about Super Bowl I?
That it was the most coverage, most excitement we had seen from the media in all the championship games we'd been in, as big as they were. And although we had no way of knowing it would grow as rapidly as it did to the heights that it did, we knew it was going to be special because of that attention. We had never seen so much media coverage ever.
It was, you were MVP of both Super Bowl I and II, if I remember.
I was, but at the risk of sounding overly humble, that is so misnamed sometimes, because a quarterback will be the first to tell you that he depends so much on the other members of his team to achieve an honor like that it's incredible. Yes, I was, and I'm honored, but we had some great, great team players. And then you have to flip that over and realize that also a quarterback comes to appreciate early in his career, and then for as long as he plays, the defensive side of this game and the kicking game. Because without them, I don't care how good you are, you're going to be in trouble. If you can't have the ball in good field positions at times, you're in real, real deep trouble.
Super Bowl II. What do you remember most about doing it again the next year? Different team, Oakland.
How difficult it was to get up for the game. We had had a very tough year in 1967 during our season due to a number of injuries. We'd had some losses, which we, because of the injuries, which had really hurt us. And so the season was a struggle. It's always a struggle to repeat anyway, and it was a double struggle, if you will, that year. And I think after we had beaten the Cowboys in the famous Ice Bowl, it extracted so much from us that we were just tired mentally, spiritually, if you will. And so when we went down to Florida to train for the second Super Bowl, we literally had to work at getting up for the biggest game of the season. And that should not be the case, but it was. And we were well into the week, I think, probably about Thursday before we really began to then come up and surface and we're ready to play on Sunday.
And you have recuperated from the Ice Bowl, folks. He's here. He's warm.
It feels good in this warm room here.
19 below. We'll be back with Bart Starr right after this. We're back with Bart Starr, MVP of Super Bowl I and Super Bowl II. And Super Bowl II, Vince Lombardi actually had announced that this would be probably the last time he was going to be with the team, correct? All together, basically. Well, so that added a little bit of an element to it.
And he didn't make it, as you just stated it, but there was a hint during some of his comments during the week that that might be the case.
Thinking back, why did he decide that was it that year after that Super Bowl?
I'm not sure. I did not ask him that specifically after he retired. Mm-hmm. But I think perhaps media and other people probably instilled in him a feeling that he had climbed all the mountains. When if you knew Lombardi, that would never be the case because there was always another one. And that was what drove us, I think, to three consecutive championships, something that no other team had ever done, was that he was always saying that it's one thing to win, it's yet another to repeat and repeat and repeat. And so I think maybe he was perhaps caught up in that a little bit, or he could have been emotionally, mentally tired. Who knows?
Sure. Do you think he regretted that?
I know he did. I talked to him a few months after he'd made that, and he made the statement in the privacy of his office he'd made a mistake.
Really?
I think that's why he returned as quickly as he did to the Redskins after sitting out the year in Green Bay, which, by the way, I think spoke volumes for what he stood for. Not one time did he ever interfere in that first year out.
Was that a reason why, perhaps, he did not win third straight Super Bowl?
No, I don't think so. Again, I think Coach Bengtson did a superb job in replacing him that following year. And just circumstantially and ironically, there were some injuries that year as well, and that can take a or play a big role and take a big toll on you. And I think that was the case.
What was the feeling when the Jets, an AFC team, won?
Well, you have to be pleased for anyone who does. When Namath made a prediction prior to the game that they were going to win and then backs it up, that also makes a very strong statement. But I think that players and coaches know better than anyone else the quality of an opponent. They have to. And we knew very well in the first two Super Bowls the quality of the Kansas City Chiefs and the Oakland Raiders. And we had great respect for them. We knew that these were teams which maybe some people didn't feel should have been there with an NFL team, but that's not the case. They were very, very talented. And ironically, both of them, just a few short years later, had their own day in the sun.
A lot of people, when they talk about Bart Starr, say, great mind. Fran Tarkenton said once that you looked over to the sidelines and told Vince Lombardi to blank off. Do you remember that? Is that true? I mean, just to show what kind of makeup, you know, how tough you were, mentally tough you were, and the confidence that you had. Do you remember that? Is that a true story? Or?
Yes, he's embellished it a little, but it's a nice compliment. But I think that those kinds of things come when you feel a great deal of confidence at the time. We were extremely well trained, and I was smart. I'd like to think that I was courageous and tough because I had to be, and I was not a physically talented quarterback. I was an overachiever. And I say that with respect for those that I have seen for years. I just simply was not in their league as a talented passer and so forth. I had great teammates around me, but I had those other qualities which enabled me to uphold the responsibilities of my position, and thankfully I did.
Who was, in your opinion, when you played, the best quarterback in the game?
Well, my all-time favorite, of course, during our era was Unitas. We've become great friends over the years. I had tremendous respect for him when he was a player and still do. I studied him. He was a star with the Colts long before I was with Green Bay, and I studied him. I had reels and reels of him in action in an attempt to help me as a quarterback. And but there are other ones out there, too, who came along behind him. As a sheer passer, Sonny Jurgensen was absolutely fabulous. And there are many others. I'm going to leave some out. But later, I thought that Staubach was the consummate quarterback. And, of course, I have tremendous respect for the Marinos and the Montanas. And was sorry to see Joe leave the game, but fully understood that, too. I think he made a wise decision. But you go down through the list of great quarterbacks over the years, and it's incredible, the fellows who've played the game.
Are you still involved as much with the game today? I mean, do you watch Sundays and keep up with all the players and all the teams? Are you attached to it?
No, I don't. No, I would need a program, as
they
say.
Really? How come? You just
well, there are other things to do. We play tennis a lot on weekends. It's about the only time I can with my wife and friends. We have three granddaughters we enjoy spending a lot of time with, and one of those times is Sundays. And so it's just not as easy.
Are you shocked by how the game has changed since you've played, as far as how much showboating there is and how much money there is? And, you know, there's just, it's a whole different complexion now, sports in general, not just football. But does that surprise you?
No, it doesn't surprise me, because I think that without sounding too philosophical here, that in itself is a little bit of the reflection of our society, and forgetting the financial side just for a moment, but we've grown, moved toward things like that. I'm happy to see some of the conditions which have been placed on actions, showboating and so forth at the collegiate level. I agree with that. I think there should be. But no, the money side is, I think, a separate issue. Mm-hmm. We live in a free society. Supply and demand drives us, and it should. And I find no problem if someone feels that a player is worth X amount of dollars and they can pay it, pay it. And more power to the player. If he, in the eyes of the ownership, has earned it, pay him or her. And so, no, I don't have any problem with that at all.
So you're not bitter at the money that's...
No, I'll take the championship rings and the great memories, and I don't want to appear flippant about that, but that was a different time. And that was then, as they say, and this is now. But we'll take the championships and the great team memories and let it go from there.
We'll be back with Bart Starr right after this. We're back with Bart Starr, who's in New York. I don't know how often you come to New York. You're an Alabama man now.
I love coming here to visit, though.
But you're here because Gene Locklear did this beautiful lithograph.
Super job. They're going to hold an auction for the originals, which will be auctioned off at Mickey Mantle's today. And the proceeds go to the Police Athletic League. I think it is a wonderful cause and, of course, a great product for Quaker State. So I'm thrilled to be identified with it.
In your Green Bay, yellow and green. Boy, what years. You know, it's just, you said it very well the last segment. You would take the legendary years that you experienced any day over the money that's in the game today. And we were talking also about how the whole personality of the game has changed. I mean, what do you think about a guy like Deion Sanders? What comes to your mind when you think of Deion?
Tremendous athlete. Fabulous, I guess, might be a better description. Obviously, a very wealthy athlete today.
Jerry Rice at the 49ers was quite outspoken recently about, hey, it wasn't just Deion Sanders that won us the Super Bowl. Do you agree with Rice in that mentality? I guess he felt that other guys were being slighted and everybody was crediting Sanders when he was there with the team.
From a team perspective, absolutely. From a personal perspective, which I do not know of, then I can't comment. But yes, teams win, individuals contribute, no question about it. They contribute heavily, but you have to have a total core of a team to win championships.
What was the media like back then in the early 60s?
Well, tremendously different than today, but again, note how our society has changed relative to the relationship of the media with different areas of our society. And so I think you have to balance that and say that, okay, that may be the case, but so it is over here in the political scene as well today. And they didn't cover the political scene in the 60s as they do today either. So I think, again, if we just take a practical approach, not make it overly simplistic for a complex situation, mm-hmm. but don't overreact to it either.
It's just almost too much, you know, as far as the scrutiny that goes on with public figures. Do you dislike that?
Well, before I answer, speaking of being too much, I have been amused. In fact, I saw a piece recently of a comedian doing this. A takeoff on some of the terms and words which we use to describe today. And if you're politically correct, they're saying that some country clubs are no longer going to refer to their golfers as with handicaps. They're going to call them stroke challenged. Well, that gives you an idea of what we're doing in our society.
That's a little sick. We've
talked to someone and it's almost become
some people could be offended
sure.
by stroke challenged, by the way.
They might, exactly. But who knows? But to say someone, we don't say a person is retarded anymore. Or we are going farther and farther away from it rapidly. Well, gosh, there was nothing demeaning about to say that. But I think it's typical of how we're trying to be so correct in everything that we say or do that sometimes I think you can overcorrect.
Tell me what you're doing now. People want to know what Bart Starr is doing. You're not that into football, maybe a little college football. But how do you spend your days?
Well, let me just clarify something. I'm an avid fan. I just don't get to follow as closely as I used to. Our company develops medical buildings around the country, and we're actively involved. We're privileged to have a great business, and we're scattered with our projects all over the country, so we travel a lot. I had always wanted to. I was in the automobile business for 19 years and loved it, but I'd always wanted to do this because of being close to conditioning and injury and surgery and rehab and so forth. And it's about 13 years ago I made the move and the decision to do so, and we've been up and running, and we love it.
You don't miss coaching?
No. I learned a great deal, but I love our work. This is something I've always wanted to do, and I'm glad we're doing it.
Coaching must have been tough, the post-Lombardi years.
Well, there were some coaches between him and the time I came.
It
really wasn't that tough. Oh, sure, you have to live with that, but... It was a great learning experience, and I think that, by the way, to switch just for a moment, the current coach, Mike Holmgren, is exceptional. I'm a big fan of his and Ron Wolf, the general manager there. I think they have the Packers going in the right direction rapidly, and for your viewers here, I really believe they're going to win their division this year. I don't see anyone there who can beat them. Look out. They're good. They're tough. They're young. They're led by a great quarterback.
That's right, Brett Favre.
Mm-hmm.
Do you talk to him at all?
Yes, I do when I get a chance. But
any advice that you have for him?
No, he's a very talented, physically talented quarterback who has done a great job, I think, of learning that system and executing it. And, man, he is good.
All right, you heard it here. Predicting they'll win the division.
Yes, sir.
Green Bay.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate you coming and sharing some of those early 60 memories.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Bart.
Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria is brought to you in part by Peak Vision Sunglasses, Zero Distortion, Patented Dual Zone Lens Technology. Learn more at peakvision.com, peakvision.com, and by Dune Jewelry and the Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com, D-U-N-E, Jewelry.com. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria. I am at the PGA Merchandising Show, and my guest is Jim Nugent, founder, publisher of Global Golf Post Plus. Jim, I've known you for a long time, and you've been in this field for a long time. Tell me about this new venture.
Thank you, Ann, and thank you for having me on today. Just about 2 weeks ago, we launched a new platform, Global Golf Post Plus, probably going to be referred to more commonly as GGP Plus eventually. We're now delivering original premium quality journalism that you can't find anywhere else in a beautiful advertising-free environment. The exchange is we're going to ask people to subscribe to it, $7 a month or $60 a year. But it's just great content from some of the best golf writers in the whole world of the global game.
And 6 days a week it's coming out.
6 days a week. We're going to publish two pieces every day. Some of it's going to be a little bit offbeat. Some of it's going to be very serious and thoughtful. It's going to be a mix, but it's going to be original, and it's going to be stuff you can't find anywhere else.
So it's digital. You obviously you have the digital magazine that you've had, for 10 years now?
This is our 10th year publishing Global Golf Post, which is distributed every Monday morning. It's free, supported by advertising. The new business, GGP Plus, is an add-on to that, so it's a second line of revenue for our company, and we're very excited after just the first two-plus weeks of doing it.
Tell me about some of the editorial, some of the subject matter that you've covered so far.
Well, just this week we had a couple of great pieces. We had a very long, almost an investigative report, the whole backstory of how the PGA of America decided to move to Frisco, Texas. Our Sean Fairholme interviewed a lot of people, not just at the PGA of America, but also on the ground in Frisco. We also had a wonderful piece by John Steinbruder this week, a profile of John Ashworth and his very interesting journey through golf, from being a caddy on the PGA Tour to starting his company called Ashworth to trying to build a golf course in Scotland. And now he's back with another soft goods company called Link Soul, and he saved a municipal golf course in Carlsbad along the way.
Well, I mean, it really, from what I've seen so far, it just seems like you are diving into some controversial territory, which I think is necessary in our sport, because I really feel that people in golf have been hesitant to really criticize, whether it's personalities or real investigative pieces.
You know, you're right. That's a fair assessment. A lot of journalism treats the game and some of its leaders and some of its institutions with kid gloves. And that's an unfortunate situation. We're not looking to cause controversy. We're not looking to be difficult to be critical for, without reason. But there are issues that arise from time to time. There's one going on as you and I speak with this young lady, Lucy Lee, a 15-year-old Asian-American girl in Northern California, appeared in an Apple spot, and her amateur status is at risk. You can't turn your back on that story. There are going to be some difficult decisions to make, and the USGA might be at fault. The family may be at fault. We just have to report the facts and be straightforward about it.
Well, you know, for instance, like when Tiger Woods was going through so much of his controversy, you know, a lot of journalists were afraid to write about Tiger Woods. They thought, oh, boy, if we expose or write anything critical of Tiger, he won't give us interviews or we won't be, you know, well thought of in his camp. But, you know, he doesn't do a lot of interviews anyway, Jim, right? So I was always kind of, really annoyed that, for the most part, most golf reporters didn't really criticize Tiger at a time when, you know, I think, you know, we could have been a little more critical of what he was doing.
I think that's fair. You know, everybody was a little bit afraid of Tiger and, to use your word, his camp. They didn't want to be on the outside looking in if and when Tiger came back and started winning majors again. But one thing that's interesting that's changed since the fire hydrant incident, if you will, is the rise of social media. And I'm not sure that the journalism community would get away with that same behavior today, because they'd be called out in social media if that were to happen.
That's true. I guess, now they have to be almost so politically correct and stay away from trouble, because they know that they could be exposed at any given moment on social media.
It's a new and very powerful force in media generally, sport to be sure, golf to be sure. It's not going away. It's only becoming more powerful and more important in our everyday life.
So talk a little bit more about the landscape, Jim. You know, the world of publishing and editorial has changed so much. I mean, you have been in the business for a long, long time, golf publishing for 25 years. And what has perhaps surprised you the most about where we are today in terms of the digital landscape?
Well, I'm not surprised. There's almost been a certain inevitability about it. Newspapers across the country rarely cover the game. In your neighborhood in New York, only occasionally does the New York Times venture out to cover a golf tournament. Across the country, most newspapers that once had golf writers that had two or three pages of golf content in season, that doesn't exist anymore. And so the digital transition that we're living through has been really, really hard on golf journalism. And that's one of the motivations that we have to launch GGP Plus, is to demonstrate that quality, premium quality golf journalism can not only survive, it can thrive in the digital world if it's done well.
And definitely, I mean, I've seen the New York Times, I've seen the New York Post, all these major institutions as far as, you know, newspapers go in New York City, they have to figure out the digital part of it or they're out of business, right?
No question. If you don't have a digital-first strategy, if you're a magazine, if you're a newspaper, your future is not very, very bright. Now, the Times is doing very well, and they're really kind of an inspiration for us because they're selling subscriptions and they've got millions of them. But most newspapers across the country and a lot of magazines are still, they're still print-centric. And as each day goes by where they don't make that transition, they fall 2 days behind.
How involved do you get in the editorial process? I know you're a big golf fan and you've been in the business for a long time. And do you and Steve Eubanks talk a little bit about that?
I don't get too terribly involved. I'm not a golf journalist. I've never pretended to be a golf journalist. I kind of set up some guidelines about, you know, what we want to do. But it's Steve Eubanks that's making the call for GGP Plus. Our executive editor, Mike Cullity, makes all the decisions as it relates to both products. I only attempt to write, and I use the word attempt, when it comes to the amateur game, for which I have a great passion. For the most part, I've got brilliant journalists. They've got years and years of experience and judgment. Far be it for me to tell them what I think they should be doing.
And based on the landscape that we've been talking about, there are probably a plethora of journalists who are out there looking, you know, for this opportunity.
We've made it clear we're an open shop, you know. We've got certainly a great lineup of really talented golf journalists on our staff from around the world. But we're open. If some of the journalists that are looking for employment or looking for other opportunities to write have a great idea, our door is open. We want to hear it, and we want to let take their content and deliver to our readers.
How have you been? What's the feedback been in just the last couple of weeks since it started? You know, how has it been going?
We're very, very encouraged. We're looking at January as kind of a soft launch, so I think we're exceeding our expectations. Interest in the game really doesn't pick up until the Patriots win another Super Bowl. So we're using this period to iron out the kinks, to get the bugs out of the website. But the early signs are very encouraging, and being here at the Merchandise Show this week has been very rewarding. I've had all kinds of positive comments from all corners of the golf business.
Well, let's see if the Patriots win. I'm rooting for them, but you're a Chicago guy now, so.
Yeah, our Bears went out early, but it's hard to bet against Tom Brady anymore, isn't it?
It is. Jim, thanks so much. Jim Nugent, the publisher, founder of Global Golf Post Plus, and continued success.
Man, I appreciate it.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. I am on the floor of the PGA Show here in Orlando, Florida, and my guest is Bud Garmany, the president of
Garmany Golf.
Garmany Golf. I love it. And you said this is kind of like your coming out PGA Show, your coming out party. You've been around for a number of years, but here you are.
Yeah, you know, and we were founded in late 2009, which is the worst year in the history of the world, to start a luxury golf travel business. But this is the first time we've ever exhibited at the PGA Show. I've attended the PGA Show many times, but this is the first time we've actually exhibited. We've grown very organically, very deliberately, which is to say somewhat slow. We really didn't do any marketing. We had two kinds of business. We had repeat and we had referral. And I sat with a good friend of mine, Lisa O'Hurley, and was able to convince Lisa to come aboard as our VP of marketing. And so as you can see with our booth, we're, you know, we say, hey, if you're going to make a splash, move a bunch of water. And I love it.
So Lisa O'Hurley, who I know very, very well, you have a great team. John was here. Talk about John's title. What did he call himself?
Yeah, it's great. John O'Hurley, you know, the famous actor who played Jay Peterman on Seinfeld. John's a good buddy and, you know, obviously came to the PGA Show here. Was in our booth on Wednesday for about 6 hours. And it was funny, Ann, because people would come up and, Jay Peterman, what are you doing here? And he says in his inimitable voice, which I will try to imitate very poorly, he said, I'm the director of ambiance. And they would laugh and then he would show them his badge. And it literally says, John O'Hurley, Garmany Golf, director of ambiance.
The best. I love John O'Hurley. So talk a little bit about the company and, you know, what your goals are with this relaunch.
So, you know, we seek to create unforgettable experiences with world-class guest service. And, you know, that that may sound like a banner or a slogan, but the reality is we live that. That's our culture. We say you won't see trips or tours anywhere in our literature. We create experiences. We don't have clients or customers. We have guests. We don't have vendors or suppliers. We have business partners. We don't have employees. We have teammates. And it's funny, and when I started this in late 2009, a lot of people gave us a little grief and said, that's just vernacular. And I said, maybe, but here's the deal. It begins with the way you think about it. Then it transcends to speaking and your behavior, and that becomes your culture. That's who you are. So we have a lot of fun doing it. We're passionate about it and just love creating great experiences.
And so tell me about some of these experiences.
Well, somebody asked me the other day, said, what's your number one destination? I said, my favorite destination is, whatever experience we're creating for the latest guest. But, Scotland, you can see on the board there behind you. Scotland's one of the boxes that anytime somebody goes abroad for the first time, that's a box they want to tick because it's a home of golf, it's a soul of golf. But we do great destinations like New Zealand, Australia. Bill Hogan, our new senior vice president of sales, he did a post, I think it was 2 weeks ago, called Garmin Golf's 9 for 19. And the first two destinations on the list were Vietnam and South Korea. And we got a lot of calls saying, wait a minute, there's great golf in Vietnam and South Korea. And it's not just great golf, it's unbelievable experiences, culinary, cultural, historical. And that's what we really try to do is create an overall experience. We always say anybody can book tea times and hotel rooms, but it takes a team of passionate hospitalitarians to create a great experience.
So Vietnam and South Korea, they are two destinations that, I don't think Americans would choose immediately as far as, destinations, right? But it sounds interesting. I know there are a lot of great golf courses there. Will Bill kind of promote these kinds of areas, maybe destinations that not every golfer would think of going to?
Absolutely. A couple things. One, Bill's played golf in 58 countries. When he first told me that, I thought, I can't even name 58 countries. In fact, I'm not even sure I knew there were 58 countries. But Bill is an incredibly well-traveled guy. And one of the things that's unique about us is we don't just have cookie-cutter experiences. We sit down and we do a consult. We say, okay, tell me about your travel history. Where have you been? What are the non-golfing experiences that, that really float your boat? And from there, then we try to match the person with the experience and the destination, not just the golf, but also the other stuff that we talk about.
I see some video behind you here at your booth, and we have safaris, which is great. There's golf all over the world. But as you say, golfers want to play the best courses all over the world, but they also want to experience the culture and see other things in the region. And, I think they want the whole package.
Yeah, that's a great point, Ann. I think that I really believe that we're at the dawn of the experience economy. I think that more and more society is less about accumulating things and more about accumulating experiences. And, great golf is everywhere, but it's really immersing yourself in the culture, the people, the landscape, the history. That's what really makes an unforgettable experience.
So tell me about your background.
So I was in the solar energy business for 14 years in Northern California, and I had a couple partners, and they had bought me out, and it was a kind of buyout where I didn't have to work for a little while, but I knew I was going to have to do something eventually, and I'd never been to Scotland. I shouldn't say always loved golf. A guy asked me on an interview the other day, he said, did you play golf growing up? I said, I grew up in East Nashville, Tennessee, kind of a rough neighborhood. In my neighborhood, you got beat up if you wore golf clothes, right? So I came to the game late in my early 20s, but I immediately fell in love with it. I loved everything about it. I loved the culture, the tradition, just the camaraderie and all. But anyway, fast forward to 2008, and 2009. I'd never been to Scotland. I wanted to tick that box, so I booked a round trip ticket, 2 weeks. I had no idea where I was going. I was landing in Edinburgh, but I knew I was going to stay in Edinburgh the first night, but I didn't know where I was going day to day. But I had a couple guidebooks with me that talked about great golf all over Scotland. I saved the last 5 days for St. Andrews, and anybody who's ever been to St. Andrews, it's a magical place. It's a soul of golf. I stood on the first tee on a beautiful Friday afternoon. I had the R&A at my back, and I'm staring down that first fairway, and I said, I don't know what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. It's going to have something to do with golf. So I went back, and Santa Cruz, California, I sat with a good buddy of mine, Timmy Lancelot, who played on the PGA Tour for 10 years and was now a club pro, and over about 12 beers, Timmy's throwing all these different options. Do you want to do this? Do you want to do this? And everything was a no. And then all of a sudden, he said, how about golf travel? And I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, you create groups, and you send them around the world, and, you get to see places. I said, you get paid for that. So 3 months later, we started Garmin Golf.
And now you are based where?
So we're moving our headquarters from Chicago to Austin, Texas, as of April 1st, which Bill Hogan, who I talked about earlier, that's where he's located. Our concierge team, led by our chief of staff, Lauren Moy, they're relocating to Austin, and that's where we'll have our headquarters. Lisa O'Hurley, our VP of marketing, she lives in Beverly Hills. So we'll have a few remote people, but our headquarters, most of our team, will be there in Austin.
And I understand you live at one of the famed courses in California.
I do. I live at I live in Lake Sherwood, right on Sherwood Country Club, right there on the 16th tee. And if you've ever been there, I mean, it's a magical, beautiful spot full of incredibly interesting people. And it's, I'm really fortunate to live there. I have two sons. They live in California. So I'll spend a lot of time in Austin, but I'll certainly spend a lot of time back on the West Coast as well.
And our paths actually crossed a couple months ago at the Scotty Medlock, Robbie Krieger Celebrity Tournament. It was the first time that I went out there and played in the tournament. It was so much fun, and you're good buddies with both.
Yeah, Scotty met. In fact, I was at Scotty's house on Saturday right before I left here Sunday morning to come to the PGA Show. But Scotty, anybody that knows Scotty, I mean, he's a world-famous painter, and Scotty's just one of those guys that he just – everybody loves Scotty. He's got a heart as big as his body. And then Robbie Krieger, who's, you know, a Hall of Fame musician for the Doors. And, you know, we're really blessed to hang out with a lot of interesting people. And the thing that we all have in common, really two things. One, we all love the game of golf. Two, we all do a lot of good work for giving back. You know, our Do Good Foundation, we raised almost $700,000 for charity last year. And obviously, if you know Scotty and Robbie and those guys, Patrick Warburton, these guys are all about doing good and giving back. And that really aligns with what our values are all about.
I love your business card. It says, what's on your bucket list? And then you bullet point Scotland, Ireland, North Ireland, New Zealand, France, Spain, Pebble Beach, England, Australia, Italy, South Africa. And wherever there is bucket list golf and unforgettable experiences to be had. That's cool. I like it. It pretty much tells everybody what Garmany Golf is all about.
Yeah, it really is. It's, you know, in fact, in one of our brochures, we actually have boxes where it has all these destinations and people can, like, tick the boxes. And somebody asked me yesterday in an interview, they said, are there any limitations to where you know, about the destinations that you'll create these experiences for? I said, there are a couple. One is we need to intimately know the lay of the land. Two, we need to have great relationships with our business partners, the hotels, the golf courses, the ground transportation providers, the restaurant, because it's really those relationships with our business partners that allow us to ensure that we're going to exceed our guests' best expectations.
Now, is Garmany Golf also packaged with championships as well?
Absolutely. We take people to the Open Championship, which obviously, as you know, is going to be in Royal Port Rush this year, which first time in 60-something years it's been outside of, you know, England or Scotland. We take people to, you know, the Masters and obviously the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach, kind of, you know, in my backyard. So we're excited about that. But, yeah, we love to – anywhere where there's great experiences, we've taken people to the Kentucky Derby and you play Valhalla, do the Bourbon Trail. And, yeah, there's anywhere where there's great experiences in, that's where you'll find us.
Hurley, director of ambiance. All right, let's think of a title for me. I'm in. Bud Garmany, thanks so much. President of Garmany Golf.
Thanks for having me, Sam. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Hope you enjoyed the show this morning. My thanks to Jim Nugent, publisher of Global Golf Post Plus, and to Bud Garmany, the president of Garmany Golf. Hope you enjoyed the replays of my sports interview classics with Deacon Jones and the great Bart Starr. And thanks to our studio engineer, Kyle Lynch. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Enjoy the Super Bowl. I'll talk to you next Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard, right here on Sports Interview with Ann LaGore.